Boo!
Are you scared? I know, I'm not that scary.
But it's almost Halloween, which usually means trick-or-treating, costume parties,
and haunted houses.
Which usually aren't that scary. I just think they're kind of fun.
This Halloween is going to be a little different. We're in a pandemic. That's frightening enough. And for many of us to get into the spooky spirit this physically distanced Halloween, we're going to turn to
horror movies.
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Oh, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
Fear is a primal emotion in all of us. And why do some of us crave to feel it with the thrill of killers, monsters, and hauntings on screen?
They stick in your psyche.
And why are some of us too afraid to watch them?
It's a minority of people who don't like it.
What's the science behind fear, and how do horror movies take advantage of this?
If the film itself is believable, you will never doubt the fear, because at that point, the fear is actually inside you.
This is Nova Now, where we push aside the werewolves, ghosts, and vampires, and we dig into the science behind the headlines, even when they're spooky. I'm Alok Patel.
Support for Nova Now comes from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, dedicated to providing compassionate care and cancer specialists who are experienced in the cancer you have. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Horror itself is an emotion. I mean, that genre, that kind of entertainment takes its name from an emotion. An emotion that is a mixture of fear and disgust.
Matthias Claesson is an associate professor in literature and media in the English department at Aarhus University in Denmark, where he studies, get this, scary entertainment.
Fear itself, that's probably the purest, possibly the oldest emotion, the response we feel when there is clear, acute danger.
He's also director of the newly established Recreational Fear Lab.
So fear makes you run away. I mean, a huge spider in my basement makes me run away. A weird noise in my basement makes me want to investigate. I mean, that's anxiety. That has me scoping the environment for danger.
So we're doing a little bit of research for the podcast and looking at some of the oldest horror movies from the late 1800s. You have the Lumiere brothers and the Dancing Skeleton, which is hilariously awesome. And Georges Méliès, that kind of short he did with devils, witches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at him now, and it's inspiring how they were so on point over 100 years ago. Why do you think horror is so popular?
I think when I have a really good, convincing, concise answer for that, I'm ready to retire. The first thing to say is it is hugely popular. It's not a niche phenomenon. It's actually more than half the population who claim to enjoy scary media. I mean, if you ask people, why do you go to watch a horror movie? They will say that it's fun or rewarding or it gives them pleasure. But I think on a deeper level, people have a biological or evolved need to play with fear, to find their own limits, to expand their own limits.
Matthias Claesson thinks that this desire to push our limits of what scares us evolved for the same reason that playtime evolved in the animal kingdom. It's all about training for the unexpected. It's a mechanism that allows us to learn about the world and ourselves. He said that, quote, a prehistoric hominid who spent all his time anxiously trembling in a cave wouldn't get to pursue adaptive activities such as finding food and mates.
And then, of course, there are other kind of social dimensions. I mean, for a lot of people, horror is really a social phenomenon, something you do with friends. And it's very possible, and that's something we're looking into, that there are bonding effects of exposing yourselves in a group to scary entertainment.
So I want to talk about your book, Why Horror Seduces. This is a description. From vampire apocalypses, shark attacks, witches and ghosts, to murderous dolls bent on revenge, horror has been part of the American cinematic imagination for almost as long as pictures have moved on screens. But why do they captivate us so? What is the drive to be frightened? And why is it so perennially popular? I'm so into that description. Can you kind of give us an overview about your findings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been very interested in my work to kind of integrate the study of horror movies with cutting edge social science, cognitive science, evolutionary anthropology, those kinds of fields. Because I think horror is so closely connected to a kind of core in human nature. Part of what I tried to do in the book also was to give interpretations of canonical, you know, hugely famous American horror movies and novels.
And can you kind of dive into one of those and tell us why that was a canonical example? Like, what was it about that movie that tapped into our need for fear?
Yeah, a good example would probably be Jaws.
The 1975 thriller about a human devouring shark that terrorizes an unsuspecting beach community, directed by Steven Spielberg.
And it's really interesting. You can see a sharp drop in beach tourism in North America just after the release of Jaws. It terrified people. It made them afraid of going to the beach. And why? I mean, what are the odds of being killed by a shark? The odds of being killed by a cow are significantly higher than the odds of being killed by a shark.
According to the CDC, more than 100 people in the U.S. died from injuries caused by cattle between 2003 and 2007. Who knew bovine could be so deadly? But compare this number to the only 5 fatal shark attacks that took place in this country during the same period of time. Yet, we are so scared of sharks.
There is something about the shark with the rows and rows of sharp teeth and the dead black eyes, and the fact that it's in an element that's kind of hostile to humans in the water, that just goes straight into the fear system. It just terrifies people. So I was trying to make sense of Jaws and the way it's shot, with the point of view shots from the perspective of the shark, the sound, the kind of signals that the shark is now coming. And we know it in the audience, and the characters in the film don't know it, and we know that they don't know it, and we know that makes them more vulnerable. So it's really a marvel of, you know, suspense creating, jaw-dropping, horror creating movie making.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
You know, in your work, you've talked about the evolved fear system. Can you explain this idea? Because I think it's awesome.
Yeah, it's a cool idea, and it's not my idea. It's an idea I've stolen from scientists. But it's the idea...
Borrowed. He borrowed it.
I borrowed it, and I put a citation on it, so all should be good. But it's the idea that humans, like pretty much all other organisms, through natural selection, the Darwinian process of evolution, have been equipped with a system that keeps us alert and alive in a dangerous world. And so the fear system, think of it as a kind of machine inside your head that keeps you constantly scanning the environment for danger. And when you detect the slightest cue of danger, and that could be walking in the woods alone and it's night, and then suddenly you hear a weird noise, the fear system will make sure that all your cognitive resources, all your attention is focused on that sound, even though you know rationally that the odds of there being, you know, a mask-wearing, chainsaw-wielding psycho killer in the woods are really, really low. The fear system doesn't care about statistical probability. It cares about keeping you alive.
This fear system is localized in our brains, and it has a range of physiologic and behavioral effects. To better understand all of this, I talked to someone who studies the relationship between the brain and the human mind.
My name is Heather Berlin. I am a neuroscientist and clinical psychologist.
She's also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. I asked her about the differences between fear and anxiety.
So anxiety is having trepidation about some potential future threat. So it hasn't happened yet. And what's interesting is that humans seem to be one of the only animals that have this anxiety because we can think into the future. And fear is basically just a current threat, right? You know, there's a predator, there's an animal, and what do you do instinctively to survive in that moment? And then there's a whole cascade of sort of neurochemical events that occur to kind of help you survive. But the anxiety is just an anticipation that a potential threat might be coming, which is a bit different. So they're all kind of interrelated. But that real raw fear is when there's a current threat in the present moment that can trigger this stress response within you that is calibrated in such a way to help you survive.
The survival response. Like, fear is what probably kept our species on the planet.
Exactly. So usually our senses will take in some information that says there's a harmful event about to happen.
Imagine you're leaving the bar, you're having a great time, you're walking home, it's late at night. but it's really dark. You don't see anyone around you. And then you turn the corner and you think you see a shadow under a streetlight.
You see there's a potential threat. It activates a part of your brain called the amygdala, which is involved in this fear response.
The amygdala is an almond-shaped structure, and it receives inputs from all of our senses.
And the amygdala is like the accelerator. You know, it says, okay, go. From there, it sends signals to other places in the brain, like the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland. It releases cortisol, adrenaline, and it kind of prepares your body to either fight or to run and escape. And sometimes there's this freezing effect as well, where you just sort of are in shock and freeze. But the most adaptive responses are to run or to fight. And so what it does is it increases your heart rate. It kind of decreases your digestive system because you don't need that, right? You want to put all your energy into like your muscles to be able to run or to fight. Your bladder relaxes. You know, you might get flushed face, your pupils dilate. It increases your blood pressure, but it's all about to get your body ready for action. So you can either escape or fight the predator. And then you can have the prefrontal cortex, which is, you can think of it like the brake system, which then sort of evaluates the situation and the context you're in and decides whether actually you should run away or fight, or maybe this is actually not that threatening of a situation. So it's a little bit slower to respond, but it might say, you know what? That's not a real killer that's going to jump out at you. So let's just calm everything down. And then activates this parasympathetic nervous system, which kind of slows down respiration and your heart rate and kind of cools down everything. So it's this process between an accelerator, which gets very quickly activated just in case you really have to respond. It wants to go before you're even consciously aware of it. And then you have the more conscious kind of prefrontal cortex, which is a little slower and can break the down, you know, say, no, wait, slow down. We don't really need to respond.
Here's what's interesting. Even though fear isn't pleasant for a lot of people, there's a whole component of fear that people seek, you know, with extreme sports, horror movies. People like, they say that, oh, fear makes me feel alive. Why do you think that is? Why is it that people want to tap into this primal emotion?
What's interesting is that the same kinds of neurochemicals that are released in the fight or flight response can also be associated with excitement or happiness. And a lot of emotion is, again, this sort of cognitive labeling, how we label it and in the context. So you can have the same exact physiologic reaction, and then you look to the context and say, oh, this means I must be excited because it's like my birthday and everyone jumped out and said happy birthday, you know, and that's a positive. So you label that. But if it was like a killer with a knife jumping at you, then that would be labeled as fear. But they both were the same elements of surprise and adrenaline.
Dr. Berlin, do you like horror movies?
You know, I do not. I am not a horror fan. I do like psychological thrillers, though, like Silence of the Lambs and like Psycho.
Speaking of horror movies, I find this fascinating when I actually really think about it. So we watch horror movies. We know they're not real. Like, yeah. We know we're watching a movie. It's fictional. But what is it about movies that gets us to have that response to, you know, these jump scares, things flashing out at us? Mm-hmm. You know, create these sustained, stressful experiences. Like, how can movies do that when we know they're not real?
You know, it has to do with the suspension of disbelief, right? So whenever we get engrossed in anything, you know, why do we cry in movies? And it all depends on how much you've kind of dissociated, in the sense, how much you've lost your sense of self and are fully engrossed in the world that the film creates. And I think really good filmmakers create a world. They have, you know, tricks of the trade, whether it's lighting or sound or movement or the pace of the scene. They know how to draw in your attention. So even though, yes, there is a part of your brain that knows this isn't real, which allows you to actually sit there under all this heavy stress, right, for so long, because that part is saying, it's okay, it's not real. Like, if it was real, you would be running out of the movie theater. So it allows you to sit there and play out these scenarios in a safe environment, but you're still engrossed enough that you're actually getting the emotional responses to them. And then they use the tricks, right? There's like the suspension music and the buildup, the anticipation, and our brain loves uncertainty. It's that buildup of tension and then the release that we really like.
The rush.
Yes. They stick in your psyche. Okay, so there's this scene in Poltergeist.
The 1982 supernatural horror film, also written by Steven Spielberg. Highly recommend it. Watch it this Halloween. You can stream it on Netflix. And also, this next section's a little bit of a spoiler alert.
The little boy is in bed, and he sits up, and it's sort of dark. It's night. There's this big clown sitting in a chair just facing him. And it has, like, a hat on with little bells on it. Now, we've all had this experience as a child. Like, some weird stuffed animal in your room and it's staring at you. And so what do? You like turn it away or put something over it so it can't be staring at you when you're trying to go to sleep. So that's what the kid does. He takes this little, I think it's like a blanket, and he throws it over to cover it up. But it slips off and the bells jiggle and he just decides to leave it and go to sleep. And then he's sleeping and suddenly, you know, you ever get that sense of like, and he just feels something's not right. He sits up, looks up at the chair. The clown's not there. Right. Already I'm getting chills. I don't know.
This is so well done. I'm like looking over my shoulder for a clown right now.
The clown's not there. So now here you have the uncertainty, the mystery, like, oh my God. So all of our brains are like, what's going on? Where's the clown? What happened? Oh, you know? So of course, how do we relieve the anxiety of uncertainty? It's about checking and reassurance seeking, right? So where do you check? Obviously under the bed. There's this creepy slow where he goes and he leans over his bed and he like pulls up the sheet and he looks and you like anticipating, right, that this clown is going to jump out at him there, right? And he pulls up the thing and there's nothing. And you just get this sense of like, ah, relief, right? Nothing to be afraid of. And then just in that moment, he sits up and then bam, the thing comes and like grabs him by the throat. And this is dramatic music. And you get like really scared out of your mind. You know, basically he grabs him from behind. And so I think that was just my worst like childhood fear.
Clearly.
The filmmakers just really got it right. Like it was that whole scenario, which we all have gone through as a kid in our privacy. Like maybe let me just check the closet just in case. Let me just turn that creepy doll around just in case. So that's that scene. It's horrific for me. And I tell you, I looked under my bed for many a night after I saw that film. So thanks,
oh my
guys,
God,
who made that film.
I think you absolutely nailed it for people when you're kind of describing the way the filmmakers just know how to get into our heads.
Master filmmakers are really good at the buildup and the anticipation, dragging that part out. Because once the actual horrible thing happens, it's almost like, okay, it's over now. The fun part is that not knowing, it's the uncertainty, it's the build.
The neural response, that primal fear emotion, is what our ancestors used when they were trying to stay alive. And it's the same response that has us engaged if you're, you know, watching a horror movie about some dude with a hockey mask and a machete trying to kill people.
That's what it looks like, yeah.
This is Matthias Claesson again.
We know very little about the actual neurobiology of horror movies. We do know something, and there was a really cool study that came out about a year ago in which a scientist put people into an MR scanner and showed them scenes from, I think it was Conjuring 2, which has to be a nasty thing when you're lying inside a huge magnet that makes a lot of noise and is claustrophobic. But it allowed them to delineate the brain mechanisms that were engaged by the horror movie, and they are the same mechanisms that are active when we respond to real danger. So yes, when we're watching a horror movie, we're kind of on a trip backwards in time to when our ancestors were huddled around the bonfire, fearing whatever might roam just outside the circle of light cast by the fire. But the thing is, those movies are designed to activate that fear system. So really effective horror movies, they bypass all your rationality, all your knowledge about film structure and patterns of editing and cinematography. And they just go straight into that fear central and make you, you know, a trembling cave person once again.
We look around the world right now. We don't really live in that safe of a world. You know, you have a pandemic, natural disasters, racial and social unrest. And, you know, on social media, I've seen a lot of comments saying, like, this is a real life horror movie. You know, you look around. So do you think our obsessions with horror and fear are actually helping us in real life?
I actually have empirical data to support such a otherwise outrageous idea. Because we did a study in the early days of the pandemic, just shortly after it was declared a pandemic by the WHO, in which we looked at psychological resilience and horror movie use. The hypothesis we wanted to investigate was, are people who watch a lot of horror movies doing a better job of handling the pandemic? Because we thought if you watch a lot of horror movies, you will have a lot of experience regulating your own emotions.
And in zombie movies, there's usually scenes of people looting supermarkets and lighting things on fire and riots and general social structures collapsing. Now, earlier this year, at the start of a pandemic, wasn't quite a zombie movie, but people still ran out and panic shopped. And supermarkets quickly ran out of everyday items, including toilet paper. toilet paper. Who knew that the tool you use to wipe your rear end would become such a prized commodity?
What we found was horror fans do indeed report less psychological distress during the pandemic. They have fewer sleep problems, fewer behavioral disturbances, fewer intrusive thoughts. And fans of alien invasion films and zombie films and so on feel better prepared for the pandemic. They have simulated a similar scenario in their imagination hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Truly scary movies need to use all sorts of tricks to engage our brains. I mean, after all, they have to tap into the ancient biological defense system every time they show us people running away from zombies or killer clowns. And a particularly important element is sound. Up next on the show, we have an Emmy Award winner who knows a thing or two about this, and she's going to reveal some secrets of her trade.
There are certain sounds that you hear only in the quietest of nights or in the most abandoned of places.
Joanna Fang works at Alchemy Post Sound in New York. She's created sounds for films, television, and interactive media for years.
I have Foley artist ears. I'm always on. My brain's constantly thinking about sound.
Movies, most of the time, have three main sound elements: dialogue, music, and sound effects. Part of that last layer is what we call Foley art. And that's where Joanna comes in.
A Foley artist's job is to reproduce a lot of the everyday sounds, including footsteps, props, and even the clothing on someone's back.
You're creating a specific sound for that visual experience.
Custom sound effects is the easiest way to think of it.
Do you think there's sounds that definitely tune people into fear?
Yeah, absolutely. We've done a lot of movies where characters are invisible or there's a ghost in the room. And as a Foley artist, sometimes I have to time creaks and snaps and pops and wood twisting to trigger characters to look one's way or look the other. A lot of those creaks and pops and snaps, they have to be designed by a human being in a Foley studio because it has to work for the stories.
You know, a lot of horror movies are based on these unknown or mythical entities, right? Yeah, monsters, aliens, ghosts, but we hear them. You know, I think about the movie Alien. How do you create sounds that make something that's not real believable to the audience?
So when it comes to, let's say, a mythical creature that we've never seen, or a dragon, or a technologically advanced sociopath stalking hallways, the way we've tried to take the sound metaphor and translate it to something more tangible, more real in this world is rather simple. First thing we do is we evaluate weight and texture. We evaluate the story. Like, what about this creature is represented in its sounds? So, for instance, one of the really interesting TV shows I've worked on is Monsterland.
The Hulu original anthology series.
Every episode, there is a monster of sorts that is tied into classic American horror mythology.
In the show, mermaids, fallen angels, and other strange beasts push broken people to commit despicable acts.
And so we're not just creating a movie monster, but we're also trying to psychologically tie it in with characters, evaluating what is real about the monster. What are those fears from? So, for example, if someone's afraid of becoming decrepit or old, and that's the fear that we want to put in the audience's heart, then maybe when the creature moves its body, you hear the sinew and the flesh moving with it. It's a matter of taking the more figurative and metaphorical and turning into something a lot more literal sonically.
This must be such a time-consuming trial and error process to really nail that. You know, I feel like Foley art in some ways is like a performance. I'm now circling back to your work. You've hunted terrorists on The Looming Tower, which is on Hulu, and rolled joints for HBO's High Maintenance. You know, you crashed a bus for Ira Glass on This American Life. Do you ever put part of your own soul, your own personality, into the sounds, into the characters you bring to life?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. I think all Foley artists are relying upon a wealth of their own personal lived experiences to come to a more literal performance of a sound. For example, one of my favorite sounds is the sound of a bathtub being filled up and splashing of water in a bathtub. Something about that's very reminiscent of warm memories from childhood, you know, being Taiwanese American, remembering the sounds of my mom cooking chow fan in the kitchen and knowing how that sounds. There's a lot of sound memories I think everyone has in their life that they take with them into the Foley stage. And I'm very lucky because as someone who's trans, someone who's Taiwanese American, someone who's lived in several different cities, I've had a chance to kind of build up this bank of highly memorable and personal sounds. The idea is to be completely transparent in the sense that if we do our jobs right, the audience won't even know we're there. But to do the job right, you have to have a basis in reality. And if you've never fought in a war and you're doing a war film, maybe it's important to go talk to somebody who did fight in a war, who knows what it sounds like and also what it feels like. Since Foley's inception, there's kind of a dated outlook that, you know, the sonic world of women and the sonic world of men were very different. Men walk heavier, women walk lighter. However, one of the big discussions that we've been having as a community has been a matter of diversity. We need Foley artists to reflect the stories and the experiences of a wide variety of people. We create our art in service to a story, but that art is very personal. And it would be amazing if I could one day look back at the Foley industry and not be the only transgender Taiwanese American Foley artist.
Joanna's work is populating our streamlining platforms this month. She's worked in Vampires vs. the Bronx, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and Cartel Land. And with her team, she worked on the remake of The Invisible Man.
A show like The Invisible Man was really interesting because obviously you have a character who is almost purely told through sound.
In this story, a crazed scientist stages his own suicide and uses his power to become invisible to stalk and terrorize his ex-girlfriend.
The biggest scene that really required the most attention to detail was the very opening of the movie when Cecilia,
the main character played by Elizabeth Moss,
is desperately packing her clothing and she's just trying to get the hell out. You know, this guy's abusive. She has lived a very controlled and restricted life. And she is very carefully trying to not make so much sound as to wake him up. But the level of emotional heightening that had to happen in her performance was really difficult. When you have a character who's trying to be quiet, but when you have a job like Foley where you have to produce sound, we have to try to balance those elements out. We still have to create some sort of sound to communicate that she is being sneaky. That scene was really hard because, you know, she's stuffing clothing into her backpack, she's tippy-toeing. All these things were really important to ratchet up the tension. And it was all a buildup to this one tense moment where she accidentally kicks the doggy bowl. It is the sound that takes everyone's breath away. It makes her stop and go, oh crap, am I being too loud, you know? So for that instance, when we did that sound, we didn't just do a normal doggy bowl. We also had another metal singing bowl that produced a more interesting sound. With a movie like The Invisible Man, a lot of the materials we were using weren't necessarily true to what was happening on screen, but were true to the emotion of what was happening on screen. So the doggy bowl, for instance, is really interesting because we have a real doggy bowl. We have a real dog. You know, we have our studio dog, Dipper, who's adorable, who comes to work with us every now and then. And the problem was Dipper was breathing too heavily. And we're trying to record the sound of these dog footsteps. So we're like, it's okay, it's fine. We tried our best. Let's just put on these gloves with their fake acrylic nails and we'll walk it like we normally do for a movie. But sometimes the real thing doesn't sound real enough for a movie, surprisingly. So oftentimes we have to cheat it or we have to augment it in a way that elevates the emotion of the scene. We're trying to get the audience to sit in the emotional perspective of the character. And to get the audience there with us, we had to get every little detail. So even at the end, as the dog bowl comes to a stop right in the frame, you see the food in the dog bowl shake a little bit. We finished the scene and I was like, there's something missing. So I went back and I just added the sound of the food moving in the dog bowl just to accompany all these different layers of sound. So that way the audience hears everything. They're hearing the real thing. They're hearing a sweetener that is elevated to the level of horror. And they're hearing the extra bit of detail that tells them that was really loud, that this is a very quiet scene and she just blew it. If a film's Foley is effective and if the film itself is believable, you'll never doubt the reality of what you're seeing on screen. And you'll never doubt the fear, because at that point, the fear isn't in the movie. The fear is actually inside you. It's not about the spooks we made. It's about the horrors we've created along the way.
I want to find this phrase one day in a fortune cookie. Fear is not around you. The fear is within you. It's like poetic, but also kind of terrifying. Nova Now is a production of GBH and PRX. It's produced by Ian Koss, Ari Daniel, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Isabel Hibbard, Sandra Lopez-Monsalve, and Christina Monin. Julia Court and Chris Schmidt are the co-executive producers of Nova. Dante Graves is director of audience development. Suki Bennett is senior digital editor. Robin Kasmer is science editor. Emma UK is research intern. And Nina Porzuki is managing producer of podcasts at GBH. Our theme music is by the eerily amazing DJ Kid Koala. I'm Alok Patel. We'll be back in 2 weeks, which is plenty of time for you to watch a few horror movies, get scared, and pay attention to all the intricate Foley design as you watch people run away from Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, Carrie, Samara, Frankenstein, maybe Dracula, Jigsaw, that thing from The Grudge, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Chucky, Annabelle, Pinhead, maybe the alien from Species, or the alien from the movie Aliens, or any alien for that matter. Horror can be fun. And your fear response is incredible and ancient. Happy Halloween. Also,
ORX MSA on ORX Op.
NASA achieved something huge.
ORX has descended low.
On Tuesday, a spacecraft called OSIRIS-REx literally touched an asteroid called Bennu about 207 million miles away from Earth.
And we have touched it!
And not just touch it. The spacecraft attempted to grab a piece of it. If it worked, that chunk of asteroid will eventually be brought back here to Earth, where it could teach us about the origins of our planet. Find out more by streaming Nova's hour-long broadcast, Touching the Asteroid. You can check it out on the PBS video app or pbs.org/Nova.